Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week two of the April 6th issue, so I'd like to read the brief and the view sections. And the first article in the brief is Iran's Heavy Hand. This is by Carl Vick. On day one, President Donald Trump urged the great, proud people of Iran to take over your government. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu echoed the call in Persian, "Do not let this opportunity slip away." Inside Iran, the response has been, "How?" Over decades, the Islamic Republic built a system designed not just to crush dissent, but to prevent it from going in the first place. Surveillance is pervasive. Opposition networks are infiltrated and organizations disappear, says Roya Boramond, who with her sister founded the Abdurrahman Boramond Center for Human Rights in Iran, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit rallying the regime's victims. They have focused their energy on preventing their opponents from getting organized. When the Israeli assault began on February 28th, the center staff was still trying to determine how many people were killed the last time Iranians attempted that Trump and Netanyahu are now urging. In January, throngs took to the streets, armed with only the belief that sheer numbers could topple the regime. If that sounds naively hopeful, at once it worked. In 1979, millions of Iranians filled the streets as part of the Islamic Revolution that culminated in the overthrow of Pahlavi monarchy. But those protests were mounted by organized groups, and the National Army had declared that it would no longer fire on its own people. The faction of activists and clerics that ultimately took power promptly established a regime committed to preventing such mobilization from ever happening again. The state was very aware of how the Shah fell, Boramond notes. They have made sure that if they have a legitimacy problem, there is no one to fill that vacuum. First, there was hunting. Back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of assassinations, explains Mehdi Yahaniyad, an Iranian activist in the United States. They removed important figures outside Iran. Shahpour Bakhtir, a former prime minister who attempted to organize opposition in exile, was stabbed to death in Paris in 1991. A regime hit squad also killed an associate of his, and the daughters of those would go on to count assassinations abroad. The current tally, 457, does not include failed attempts like the one involving a Hell's Angels member who, after being hired in 2023 to kill an Iranian exile in Maryland, was arrested before he could fulfill a vow to erase the head from the torso. Nor does it count the three attempts to kill anti-regime activists. Boramond once recalled how, after a hitman was photographed on the porch of Alinejad's Brooklyn home, people were crying in, like in Canada, saying, "We are safe nowhere." Inside Iran, the warnings are even clearer. In The Chain Murderers of the 1990s, Dissident intellectuals were killed by axe, staged robbery, poison, and slit throats. In 1996, intelligence agents attempted to send a bus of riders over a cliff. A passenger grabbed the emergency brake after the driver leaped from the vehicle. In time, overt killings gave way to imprisonment. They killed the writers before, a Tehran movie theater manager told me in 2004. Now they put them in prison. In a section of the Kevan prison reserved for political prisoners, interrogators pummeled human rights advocates, journalists, and union activists with questions calculated to display the state's seeming omnipotence. They knew that everything, my whole life, one of the translators explained after emerging from the interrogation. When the agents arrived to make an arrest, they seized phones and computers along with the suspect. If they just held you for a week, you would be in awe, says Siamak Namal, a dual Iranian U.S. citizen who spent 8 years in Evin prison. Ordinary Iranians got the message as well. Attend a protest, and days later, the message arrives. Is it really worth it? The regime's own paranoia is not entirely unfounded. After President George W. Bush launched a program to promote democracy in Iran, a handful of activists were invited to workshops in nearby Dubai. Three returned early to Tehran after realizing that they were being taught to foment the kind of grassroots evolution that in the early 2000s toppled dictatorships in Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, and exactly what the regime was on the lookout for. Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, a student of the downfall of the Soviet Union, was intent on undercutting the building blocks of democratic civil society, from the teachers' unions to an independent press. He also, after the stolen 2009 presidential election, signaled that the system was closed to reform, expanded security forces, including the head-cracking Bazigi militia. The tentacles of the police state are now reaching into the far corners of the country, says Hushang Chibai, professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. I know people from several areas in Iran, she said, and you know in our village we never had a presence of the government. We had a village mayor, and that was it. For now, 2 kilometers from the village, we have a little Basili base. As it stands, the most organized opposition groups may be factions that competed for power in 1979. Reza Pahlavi, eldest son of the overthrown Shah, has lived in exile in the United States for almost his entire life, but he retains a presence in the Iranian households via satellite television. His name is sometimes chanted at protests, and he has vowed to hold elections if returned to power. The Mojahedin Khalek, MEK, founded as a Marxist movement and lobbying abroad at the National Council of Resistance of Iran, announced provisional government. But the group remains deeply unpopular inside Iran, having aided with the Iran during the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. Kurdish militia and political groups concentrated in western Iran also represent a form of organized opposition, but their call for autonomous rule, if not a dependent state, unnerved Iranians and raised fears of fragmentation given the presence of other ethnic minorities within Iran's borders. If the proponents have a long history of fighting one another as well as the regime, the war, however, has ignited an effort to forge a united front. The Iran Freedom Congress is scheduled to convene in London in March 28th and 29th. Preparations began between the January massacre of protesters and the February 28th start of the joint U.S.-Israeli air assault. It was something unique in Iranian politics, says Hossein Razga, an Iranian journalist based in Europe, who represents the most prominent political prisoners in talks to organize the Congress. There was no leak. After demonstrating that disparate groups can work together, Razga says, democratic activists will welcome the help of any country and any international institution that would help them form a peaceful transition. But, he says, no military intervention. Our next story in the brief is Zelensky's drone diplomacy. And this is by Nandika Chatterjee and Richard Hall. It was just over a year ago that Donald Trump told Volodymyr Zelensky that he didn't have the cards right now. Today, the war in Iran may just have improved the hand that the Ukrainian president has. Iran's deployment of masses of low-cost drones to attack the Gulf and Israel, hitting infrastructure, U.S. bases, and apartment buildings, has exposed a critical gap in the region's defenses. While the countries on the receiving end of those attacks possess sophisticated missile defense systems like the U.S.-made Patriot, they have struggled to absorb the high volume of Iran's cheap, expendable, one-way Shahed attack drones. Ukraine has been fighting off those same drones for years. Ukrainian officials say that Russia has fired tens of thousands of Shahed-type drones at its cities since Moscow launched its invasion in 2022. Out of necessity, Ukraine has developed a multi-layered network of drone defense that is suddenly in high demand. It combines radar detection, electronic jamming, and interceptor drones designed to hunt down Shahids mid-air. Ukraine's expertise in this area has given Zelensky a diplomatic boost at a time when his country's armed forces are under pressure on the battlefield and the U.S. has been pressing him to accept unfavorable ceasefire terms with Russia. Zelensky told Britain's parliament on March 17th, that 11 countries, including the U.S., had asked Kyiv for help in combining the drones and that 200 Ukrainian military advisors were already in the Middle East offering advice on how to defend against them. Agreements are already in place, he said. In a briefing in Kyiv on March 14th, Zelensky said that President Trump himself had expressed an interest in purchasing Ukraine's drone defense technology. Zelensky does not intend to give away this expertise for free. He has said that Ukraine is open to long-term deals that grant access to its drone defense in return for money and other weaponry that its armed forces might need. Despite growing international interest in Ukraine's anti-drone technology, Trump has publicly downplayed the need for Kyiv's assistance. "We don't need them to help in drone defense," Trump told Fox News Radio in an interview on March 13th. "We know more about drones than anybody." In a CNN interview on March 15th, Zelensky was asked if Trump's remarks suggested some resentment toward him. "I don't know," he responded. "Middle East countries and American bases, they need interceptors. It's drone interceptors, it's new technology, and it's our technology." Continuing with the brief in this week's Time, folks, we're going to read another story, and this one is, "Could Iran Retaliate on U.S. Soil?" This is by Connor Green. After the massive U.S.-Israeli air assault, Iran retaliated militarily across the Middle East, firing missiles and drones into a dozen countries since February 28th. But the regime also has a long history of mounting terror attacks. Asked in March whether Americans ought to worry about attacks at home, Donald Trump told Time, "I guess." "While the threat is very significant," says John D. Cohan, who served as Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis during the Obama administration, "the good news is that the level of understanding and sophistication, especially amongst U.S. state and local law enforcement, has increased dramatically over the last decade and a half." Time spoke to Cohen as well as Bruce R. Hoffman, a counterterrorism and insurgency expert who has served in advisory roles to multiple federal agencies, about what to know about the potential threat that Iran poses. What capability does Iran have to attack the United States? Cohen: Iran has created a global cyber attack capability, working closely with countries like Russia. It also has an extensive presence in Canada, Mexico, Central America, and South America. Hoffman: Over the decades, there have been reports and, in some cases, arrests of Iranian sleeper servants in the United States. However, over the past decade or so, it seems that these assets, if they did exist in the United States, have atrophied. Compared with other wars that the United States has been involved in, how is the threat different this time around? Hoffman: Terrorism is now seen as one of the many other threats to the United States. Consequently, over the past 8 years or so, we have seen resources, especially following the defeat of the ISIS capabilities, shifted away from counterterrorism to counterintelligence, and to other threats. Are the scenarios that you think are more likely than others? Cohen: Experts that we worked with, they've always said that if you want to understand what Iran is going to do, look at what is being done to it. Iran is typically very careful not to go beyond the tactics that have been employed against it. So, as we're looking at the current conflict, we're seeing the targeting of government officials. We're seeing the targeting of petrochemical facilities. Those examples are of things that we did to Iran. Does Iran have the infrastructure or the intelligence to replicate U.S. attacks? Cohen: Yes. While not on the same scale, Iran does have operational capabilities to replicate many of the attack techniques used against it. It has an extensive global cyber capability. They have over a decade to develop their playbook and incorporate emerging technologies such as AI and drones into their attack scenarios. Can you explain the threat of Iranian proxies to the United States? Cohen. Iran has strong financial and operational relationships with groups like Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, and even criminal organizations, where they will use these groups or operators associated with these groups to engage in acts of targeted violence in cyber attacks. What capability does Iran have to carry out drone strikes on the United States? Cohen. Iran has a significant presence in Mexico, Central America, South America, Canada, even the United States, through its military and intelligence operatives, its proxies, its relationships with criminal organizations, in particular those operating south of the border. They have the ability to access the expertise, the personnel, and the equipment to conduct drone attacks in the United States, and now they have the incentive. Hoffman. Drones are easily transportable, so they could be brought into the country, smuggled across borders, and I think there's a range of possibilities. Our next story, folks, is the good question in the brief. And the good question this week is, what's the political cost of pricey oil in an election year? This is by Philip Elliott. If Republicans can't get their arms around the spiraling cost of oil, they might need to get familiar with a new greeting. Hello, Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. The joint U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran brought the single biggest disruption in oil in history. Markets responded rationally, with panic. A gallon of gas was up almost 50 cents in the first week as the White House offered confoundingly mixed messages about when this war might end or what would be considered a victory. The metric Donald Trump offered on March 13th for the war's end, quote, when he feels it in his bones, end quote. The Republicans' hopes of holding on to their slim majority in the House and Senate may end up hinging on the cost at the pump when voting starts in just a few months. And the math is pretty clear. There is a correlation between the cost of oil and losses endured by the party running the White House. The pattern can be seen going back half a century. The government's own energy think tank is warning that costs are going to stay up at least into 2027. The three midterms in which the price of oil was adjusted for inflation, hovering around or above $100 a barrel at this point in the cycle, the party in the White House lost 29 House seats on average, according to a Time analysis. Speaker Mike Johnson can afford to lose just one vote to keep his gavel. Trump's salvation may be that it's only spring. When oil prices slide lower as it gets closer to Election Day, as they did in 2014 and 2022, wave elections can end up blunted. But the numbers that we're seeing now offer little comfort for the GOP strategists hoping to ride out this Middle East turmoil. They've gone up probably less than I thought they'd go up, Trump said on March 9th. As he faced a brutal grilling about oil prices that could upend the economy and the last 2 years of his presidential power. The calendar year began with oil at $57 a barrel. Analysts warned that it could cost triple that by the end of March if the Iran conflict continues to clog the Strait of Hormuz, a route that sees about one-fifth of the world's crude oil production. Republicans can't help but notice the peril. In 2010, oil in today's dollars reached $113 in March of that midterm, and Democrat President Barack Obama saw his party lose 64 seats. 4 years later, things looked just as bad for Obama when the crude that March hit $132 in today's money. Oil prices fell closer to Election Day, but Obama lost 13 more seats. Trump's last midterm election in 2018 was more of a mixed bag. At this point in the cycle, oil was just $79 in today's dollars. But prices rose from March to September when voters start paying attention to elections. Trump lost 42 allies in the House, but picked up seats in the Senate. Nimble messaging cannot mask the hard truths of commodity prices. Senate Majority Leader John Thune conceded on March 9th that the price of gas is always kind of a benchmark, and said that politicians need to hear voters' concerns. But there wasn't much that could be done about it in the Strait of Hormuz at making that impassable. To be fair, presidents typically get disastrous midterm report cards from voters. Since the Great Depression, only two midterms have shown positive trends for the party in the White House. The impeachment-weary 1998 electorate let President Bill Clinton's party pick up four House seats, and the post-9/11 2002 midterms gave President George W. Bush a net of eight seats. Otherwise, the history has a parade of solid rejections of the party in power. In this election cycle, the greatest unknown may be that Trump's metrics put Iran's awareness of the pain that it can do economically. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, embraces environmental warfare. Closing the strait has figured in its battle plans for decades. Experts warn that even if mines are removed, Iran may find other ways to unsettle the maritime insurers who simultaneously decide where the ships venture. On March 11th, the IRGC spokesperson said, "Expect oil at $200 a barrel." Our next story, folks, is after youth-led protests, Nepal votes for a rapper to be their next leader. Bilendra Shah, a 35-year-old rapper-turned-politician, could soon be Nepal's next prime minister after his party won a sweeping parliamentary majority in March 5th elections. Shah's Kachistra Swanta Party, RSP, formed 4 years ago, dominates the lower but more powerful chamber, having secured 182 of 275 seats. Kathmandu's former mayor, more popularly known as Balan, campaigned on being unbeholden to the Nepali political establishment. The RSP's rise is a marked shift for the small Himalayan country of 30 million wedged between India and China. Power in Nepal has largely rotated between major parties for decades. But discontent over perceived corruption among political elites boiled over in September when young Gen Z protesters took to the streets and stormed federal buildings. At least 77 people died in the violence, and then Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli was forced to resign. Shah stands out among Nepali politicians not only for his signature black rectangular glasses, but also for his roots in hip-hop, reportedly inspired by American musicians Tupac Shakur and Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. While pursuing studies in engineering, Shah was already making an impression in Nepal's hip-hop scene, both online and on the streets in the early 2010s, with lyrics reflecting Nepali social issues like poverty and income inequality. Shah's tenure as mayor of Kathmandu from 2022 to earlier this year was defined by a massive cleanup campaign that earned him both praise and criticism. His anti-establishment, Khan-E frontal approach to government made him the face of the protest last year, which he said he backed. Sujeev Shakya, who chairs Kathmandu-based think tank Nepal Economic Forum, says he expects that as Prime Minister, Shah will take transparency to a different level. And this is by Chad D. Guzman. Folks, how about finishing up the brief section of this week's Time magazine with some health news? Five symptoms that neurologists say never to ignore. And this is by Angela Haupt. It can be hard to wrap your head around all the conditions that neurologists treat. Cerebrovascular disorders like smoke and carotid artery disease, seizure disorders, neurodegenerative diseases such as ASA, Alzheimer's, and frontotemporal dementia, headache and facial pain disorders, movement disorders including Parkinson's, muscle diseases, sleep-related conditions like narcolepsy, and much more. If there's a nerve somewhere, a neurologist could get involved, says Dr. Andrew Dorsch, Division Chief for General Neurology at Rush University System for Health and a Neurological Rehabilitation Specialist. And there are nerves everywhere in the body. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with the nervous system, and it can take quite the detective to figure it out. Often, he adds, people brush off neurological symptoms for a long time, pinning their symptoms on age-related aches and pains, or assuming that they'll resolve on their own. That could be a mistake. We asked four neurologists which symptom you should never ignore and what they might signal. Number one, weakness in one hand or leg. If you're dragging one leg behind you or having trouble writing with your dominant hand, scientists say to schedule a doctor's appointment. People come months after their symptoms start, but weakness is one that you can't ignore, says Dr. Luis Cruz Saavedra, a neurologist with Memorial Hermann Health System. A lot of the people think, oh, it's just a pinched nerve, but it could actually be a stroke, it could be a brain tumor, and it could be a disorder like multiple sclerosis. It could be any sort of brain inflammation. Problems with speech. Stroke is a major cause of death in the United States, yet people often delay seeking care. I hear all the time how someone's having stroke symptoms and their reaction is, well, I'm going to take a nap and see if they go away, says Dr. Enrique Lira, director of the Division of Cerebrovascular Diseases at the University of Iowa. One way that these urgent symptoms manifest is trouble speaking. People might start slurring their words, speaking slowly, or experiencing difficulty finding words, or even be unable to comprehend what others are saying, Lira says. Difficulty getting out of a chair on a regular basis. As people get older, they tend to develop problems with daily movement. Some complaints stand apart, however. If you're regularly having trouble getting out of your chair, it's a good idea to schedule a doctor's appointment. Sure, there could be some joint issues, but we really want to take a look and make sure that you don't have an issue with your muscles or your nerves or your spinal cord, Dorsch says. That is something that I would want a family member to go get checked out right away. Persistent muscle twitches. Everyone's muscles twitch from time to time, usually at various locations. If you experience these fascioculations in the same place consistently, however, it's worth bringing it up to your doctor, says Dr. Alexandru Otaru, a neurologist at the University of Maryland, St. Joseph. It's possible that you could have a benign fascicular syndrome, which is harmless, or a more serious condition like spinal stenosis or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. A sense of déjà vu. Everybody experiences déjà vu, the uncanny sense that something has happened before. But if you're having episodes of déjà vu on a regular basis, you probably want to bring it up and get it checked out, Dorsch says. That's because it could be a warning sign of a temporal lobe seizure. Dorsch recently treated a patient who was having recurring episodes every week or every couple of days, which is not how often people usually get déjà vu, he says. Folks, you're listening to Time Magazine. This is week two of the April 6th issue. We've just finished reading the stories in the brief, and now we're moving along to the View articles. And our first one is The Science of Skepticism. Scientists once thought that illness was caused by miasmas, foul vapors that drifted through the air. For centuries, they were certain that the sun rotated around the earth. Until the 1950s, they believed that lobotomies were the best way to treat mental illness. Why did we stop believing these things? In each case, skeptics used the scientific method to produce data that disproved the incumbent theories. They hypothesized, experimented, observed, analyzed, iterated, and then publish the results, precipitating a shift in our collective understanding of the world. Doubt and debate are the prisms that test current ideas and help to generate new ones. Perhaps, then, it's good that it's now more popular than ever to be skeptical of science. Yet this most recent wave of skepticism is different. Its loudest voices are making evidence-free claims about COVID, climate change, and vaccines, presenting personal opinions as though they are facts, with no regard for experiments or data, makes a mockery of the scientific method. This is profoundly dangerous. The scientific method is the most powerful tool that humans have to change the world. It's how we, together, convert the unknown to the known, resolving uncertain and productively metabolizing scientific doubt when it arises. At its best, the scientific method consigns the worst fates that befall humans, debilitating illnesses, devastating diseases, to history. It heals the sick and feeds the hungry. Science makes miracles. American investments in science turned our country into the world's economic, technological, and military superpower. According to an estimate from the National Science Foundation, as much as 85% of all U.S. GDP growth since the end of World War II is attributed to advances in science and technology. The computer or smartphone you may be reading this on would not exist but for the scientific method. The banana you ate for breakfast would have been wiped out by a devastating crop disease years ago, and the flu that you had last week might have presaged your funeral this week. Without science, we would all be poorer, sicker, and less safe. If the scientific method is corrupted, we won't just stop making new miracles, we'll undo the proven discoveries of the past. Consider, for example, the increasing rejection in certain quarters of the science that led to mRNA vaccines and many childhood vaccines. Who's to say that the same pseudo-arguments won't apply to life-saving cancer treatments or to anesthesia or to germ theory? It might sound alarmist to suggest that we could regress to 1900, when the average life expectancy in the United States was just over 47 years old, and pneumonia and influenza were the leading causes of death. But consider that measles, a deadly disease that was declared eliminated in this country in 2000, will formally lose that designation if the 1,362 cases documented in the United States since the start of 2026 continue to spread in the weeks ahead. For context, there were 2,283 confirmed measles cases reported in the United States in all of 2025. Report confirmed cases in the first 2 months of this year are already over half that number. Ignoring the overwhelming evidence of vaccine efficacy is an abandonment of the scientific method. At the same time that some of the United States are undermining the scientific method, the Chinese government has been investing heavily in it. In just the past decade, China has increased its spending on the scientific method through a 400-fold increase in biopharma research and development spending. China now treats a higher share of global biotech patients than the U.S. and has a similar number of novel medicines under development. If we continue to discredit the scientific method, the U.S. risks becoming an innovation desert, reliant on other countries for new medicine and technologies, and helpless to protect our own people in times of crisis, ranging from biological warfare to the next pandemic. Even more terrifyingly, we risk our health. We risk not having an answer when disease strikes, and losing infants and children to diseases that their vulnerable bodies aren't yet mature enough to withstand. We risk missing out on the next genuine evidence-based science revolution. We can choose to keep our miracle machine running. We can insist that skeptics express their doubts through the scientific method in the best tradition of history's most respected scientists. Or we can continue to abandon the scientific method and throw a wrench into the gears of science, damning ourselves to a future of disease, deprivation, and decline. Next in the brief is The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. As the world watches the still unfolding U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, the government in Venezuela, a regime now much more amenable to accommodation of President Trump, looks to find new footing. The remade leadership is working with Washington to revive a long stagnant economy, and there's early progress to report. In March, Trump moved to formalize American recognition of the administration led by Delcy Rodriguez, a now pliable veteran of the old regime, by restoring U.S. diplomatic ties which had been severed in 2019. The move not only opens the door to a normalization of Venezuela foreign policy, it could also allow the government to access a long locked up assets abroad, like $4.8 billion in gold now held at the Bank of England, and about $5 billion in drawing rights from the IMF. Though a restructuring of Venezuela's debt remains a distant prospect, Washington's formal recognition does bode well for private sector engagement with Rodriguez's government. Higher oil prices, driven by the war in Iran, might also boost Venezuela's recovery. One additional early sign of stability. Trump now refers to Rodriguez as the president. For now, the Trump-Rodriguez working relationship leaves Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who famously gifted her 2025 Nobel Peace Prize to Trump, out in the cold. Machado has promised to return to Venezuela in the coming weeks, though she doesn't appear to have Trump's blessing. Voluminous evidence indicated that her party's surrogate candidate handily defeated then-incumbent Nicolas Maduro, who decreed victory. Machado remains the most popular figure in Venezuela, and credible polls suggest that if a national election were held today, she would defeat Rodriguez by more than 2-1. And she is not the country's only opposition figure. Enrique Marquez won less than 1% of the vote in 2024, but the ruling party is much more likely to negotiate with him than with Machado, making him a potential alternative. Marquez was also an invited guest at Trump's State of the Union address, a sign that the White House is willing to throw weight behind figures that they believe can facilitate a smooth transition. Marquez and others will have time to build their political profiles. The U.S. State Department has reaffirmed Washington's commitment to a phased transition to a democratically elected government in Venezuela, which would help allow the new government to secure major new investments from abroad. But Trump's immediate focus on economic stabilization suggests new elections probably won't happen before the second half of next year. If the Rodriguez government can sustain a pragmatic working relationship with Trump, the vote could be put off even longer. In the meantime, she will try to manage a gradual political opening that establishes credibility with Washington and other foreign governments without throwing the ruling party and the country into more political turmoil. It's also possible that Rodriguez has a long-term political future. For now, any Venezuelan national election that is legitimately free and fair would produce an opposition victory. But recent polls put Rodriguez's approval rating at 37%, not far from the 40% threshold that incumbents around the world typically need to win. And if Venezuela's economy finally picks up steam, and the opposition remains as divided as it has been in the past, Rodriguez's win becomes conceivable. With the war in Iran raising risks for Trump's standing, he needs a positive story to tell. Venezuela provides one, at least until the U.S. resident shifts his attention to the prospect of a dramatic change in Cuba. The next story in the brief is the CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Warland. In some ways, the annual summit on the Sustainable Markets Initiative was notable merely for continuing on. Convening CEOs from major American firms like Bank of America and Trane Technologies at an event with sustainability in the title is no easy feat in 2026 amid an accelerating energy crisis and a U.S. administration keen on attacking anything with even a veneer of green. But the discussions in London in March actually underscored how the current economic and geopolitical context amplify the business case for sustainable practices. The global benchmark price for crude oil quickly topped $100 a barrel when Iran shut down transit through the Strait of Hormuz. The picture is even worse for gas. The spot price for liquefied natural gas doubled in parts of Asia, leading factories to close. You're all CEOs, and I'm sure you're sitting around and saying, well, now we've been reminded of what we learned in 1973, which is, you need energy independence. John Kerry, the former U.S. Secretary of State and climate envoy, told the crowd, you're not safe. There's no security if you are dependent on the Strait of Hormuz or the Red Sea or somewhere else. In the past, geopolitical conflagrations have been framed as a matter primarily for nation-states to address. And despite the obvious advantages, renewable energy hasn't always won out in challenging moments, as governments have often relied on easier short-term subsidies for existing energy sources to quell consumer and voter concerns. This time around, energy price volatility is a wake-up call for corporate leaders newly empowered to do something. Many companies are facing what's in effect a COVID moment, a monumental breakage in supply chains, says Ron O'Hanley, the CEO of U.S. financial services giant State Street. When we get to the other end of this, no one is going to leave themselves to be exposed like that. The possibilities for big companies to respond effectively on their own have changed dramatically in the past two decades. The widespread adoption of power purchase agreements has allowed big companies to lock in fixed prices for renewable electricity for decades. Efficiency solutions spurred by the climate and sustainability push over the past two decades, from smart buildings to low-carbon vehicles, have made it easier for companies to quickly realize a return on such investments. And technology like solar and battery storage have enabled companies to affordably invest in their own power generation. As Australian mining magnate Andrew Forrest told me, if you democratize your energy and bring your cost down to what it should be, which is the cost of capital plus maintenance, then you're going to have abundant energy for citizens and shareholders. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine for today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening in The Brief and The View. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.